From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Matt Holzman, sitting in for Claude Brodesser-Ackner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that, and prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Business, animation had lost its luster until Pixar came on the scene and shined it up. Today we talked to one of their chief polishers, Brad Bird, the writer and director of The Incredibles and Ratatouille. Plus, do movies make money? But first, it's the Hollywood News Caravan. Don't know where, it's The Business from NPR. So, where are the writers and the studios in their contract talks? They're both maintaining a radio silence, which seems like a blessed relief from the carping they'd been engaged in since before the directors cut their deal. But the Los Angeles Times reports that the two sides are talking and making progress. They've, quote, narrowed the gap in some key areas, and there's, quote, guarded optimism. For my part, I am not, quote, holding my breath. Elsewhere, there has been a major development in the battle between agents and managers. By law, agents hook their clients up with work, while managers can only provide career advice. But the two were often at odds when a manager occasionally procured a job for a client. In some cases, the client could then blow the whistle on their own manager, dump them, and refuse to pay past management fees. That's what happened between actress Rosa Blossi and her managers, Marathon Entertainment. After a long legal battle, last Monday, the California Supreme Court unanimously upheld a lower court's ruling that the state's Talent Agencies Act prohibits managers from procuring jobs for their celebrity clients. But the court weakened the penalty for managers who flout the law and recommended that the law be rewritten. Now, this may mean very little to you, but let me tell you it means a lot to managers. Finally, Movie Guide, the so-called family guide to movies and entertainment, announced their nominees last week for the $100,000 Epiphany Prizes for Inspiring Movie and TV of 2007. The prizes are given to the movie and television show that, quote, resulted in a great increase in either man's love of God or man's understanding of God. Now, we would normally say something snarky here, but these people need all the support they can get, because according to their mission statement, Movie Guide is, quote, dedicated to redeeming the values of the entertainment industry, unquote. And that, my friends, is a tall, tall order. And that's the Hollywood News Caravan. Later in the show, do movies make money? But coming up next, Pixar's Big Bird. You're listening to The Business from NPR. In Disney's heyday, animated films were works of art, with 1940's Fantasia perhaps their crowning achievement. But Disney lost their animation mojo for decades until the early 90s, when they got reanimated with the help of new computer technology, starting with Beauty and the Beast.
Both a little scared, neither one prepared, Beauty and the Beast.
They went on to crank out a string of musical hits through the decade, but while Aladdin and The Lion King and others made money, their trademark, soft around the edges, Disney-fied sensibility reinforced the idea of animated features as cartoons for kids. By about 2000, Disney's animated films started showing diminishing returns, and other studios had entered the animated act big time.
Shrek!
That was really scary. And if you don't mind me saying, you definitely need some Tic Tacs or something, because your breath stinks.
But back in 1991, Disney had made a prescient three-picture deal with a Northern California computer company called Pixar. Their first film, Toy Story, came out in 1995. It used fantastic new computer-generated graphics and great storytelling and characters, and it began to change feature animation as we know it.
For anyone who's ever wondered what toys do when people aren't around.
Hey, everybody! It's showtime!
Walt Disney Pictures invites you into a world where toys come to life.
Toy Story was a great movie for kids, and it was perfect for the kind of promotional and licensing deals that were Disney's bread and butter. But Toy Story was not just a movie for kids by any means. 8 successful features and 46 Oscar nominations later, if you include their shorts and scientific awards, Pixar has become the stuff of Hollywood legend. Their success not only changed how the business and audiences felt about animation, but how the Motion Picture Academy dealt with it. They created the Best Animated Feature category in 2001. But what makes Pixar so successful? In a word, they're people. That's really two words, but you know what I'm saying. Anyway, one of those people is Brad Bird, who wrote and directed their 2004 hit The Incredibles and their newest film, Ratatouille, the story of a rat who loves to cook.
First of all, I'm a rat, which means life is hard. And second, I have a highly developed sense of taste and smell.
Brad Bird's been in animation for a very long time. When he was only 14, he sent his first homemade animated film to Disney Studios. They were so impressed that they invited him to come by and learn from Milt Kahl, one of the original Disney animators known as the Nine Old Men. So, when Pixar was bought by Disney in 2006, it was a homecoming of sorts. The business host Claude Brodesser-Ackner spoke to Brad Bird from Pixar Studios in Northern California.
In some ways, he probably was not an ideal teacher candidate because he was volatile and he tended to frighten a lot of people that he worked with because he had very strong opinions and he wasn't shy about voicing them. You know, any illusions I had about thinking that I was, you know, hot stuff were quickly dashed by just going into the lion's den with these guys.
Now, you've said that Milt Kahl specifically taught you, and I'm quoting you here, animation must always be the best graphic representation of an idea, end quote. You know, whether that's courage or evil or cowardice or whatever. That seems like a very sophisticated concept, even for a 14-year-old wunderkind. I mean, did you understand that at the time or did it come later?
You know, he personified it in what he said to me. But more importantly, his work personified it. You know, he would say to me, you know, you haven't even explored the possibilities. And that's one thing to say that criticism. But then I looked at how he worked and he was constantly exploring. I mean, every single pose that he was drawing, he tried, you know, 15, 20 different ways in little sketches. And the relentlessness of that, the fact that he was never resting on his laurels or being lazy, that he was always pushing, made a big impact on me.
Could you give me an example of like one of your characters that you could literally point to and say, that's because of Milt Kahl?
If you want to have an example for Ratatouille, there's a moment where the chef, the little evil chef Skinner, right after the restaurant critic has eaten the ratatouille and really likes it, where the Skinner character tastes the ratatouille and he wants them to fail. He tastes it and it tastes really good. And that makes him really angry and mystified and all of these things at once. You know, you're seeing enjoyment, total anger, and total how can this happen all in the space of a couple of seconds. But it's having very clear ideas of what you want to convey and then finding a way so that the audience sees them without exaggerating them too much.
Well, speaking of Ratatouille, which is, we should point out, nominated for 5 Oscars, including Best Animated Feature and Screenplay, I want to ask you, what do you think of the category of Best Animated Feature Film?
Well, you know, I'm gratified that people are acknowledging the fact that a lot of really interesting movies are animated. At the same time, there is somewhat of a feeling like you're being set off to one side as if we are not also film. But I think that that's changing as well. And the fact that it was nominated for screenplay and music and sound along with other live action films tells me that perceptions are changing. So, you know, it's saying that it's a separate kind of filmmaking, and that's only process. Storytelling is storytelling, no matter what your medium is. And the language of film is also the same. You're still using close-ups and medium shots and long shots, and you're still trying to introduce the audience to a character and get them to care. I don't know. I feel uncomfortable, though, because any recognition and honor is very touching and welcome.
You mentioned earlier, you know, the idea of being a part in terms of Oscar recognition. But it also seems like Pixar's success comes from it not being part of Hollywood in any way.
Certainly, if the idea for Ratatouille had been, you know, if it were only done on the basis of it being easy to sell, it never would have gotten the green light, ever. It's cooking and France and rats, and none of these areas are high concept ideas. But the fact that Pixar would go ahead with it just based on, you know, they found the idea entertaining and they felt that they could make a good film out of it, something that would be intriguing and unusual. That was the entire basis of their decision. They didn't go out and get a bunch of pie charts and figure out that this was going to surf the next wave. You know, it's a very old-fashioned, actually, way of approaching the movie business. It's kind of all built around gut instinct of like, hey, do I like that idea? Great, let's make it. It's not any more complicated than that. And that's really rare nowadays. And I can't tell you really why. Because everybody has all these, all this research being done, and yet I don't see any higher percentage of hits being made. And nobody seems to acknowledge that, you know, that instinct is at least as good and almost always better than all of this sort of computerized data and pre-testing of titles and all this sort of ridiculousness that makes people feel secure but shouldn't.
Mm-hmm. What is it specifically about the process that cannot, for whatever reason, be replicated down south, 500, 600 miles, whatever it is?
The bottom line is there is going to be, you know, at some point, a film that doesn't, you know, do as well as we'd like it to do. And we still, hopefully, won't regard that as a failure. You know, we'll, you know, only two of Disney's first five movies, all of which are regarded as classics today, made money on their initial release. You know, only Snow White and Dumbo did. Bambi and Pinocchio and Fantasia were all financial failures. And that seems impossible to think of now. If you look at them adjusted for inflation, they're among the most successful films ever made. But it took time for them to find their audience. And I think that catering to an audience or trying to cash in on a trend or anything like that, I think that you're headed for trouble. And I think one of the most refreshing things about Pixar is that they don't feel that they've figured it out. They just feel like they're the happiest with this model, which is a lot about instinct and a lot about what would we like to see on the screen. Lasseter says quality is the best business policy, and I agree with that.
But you also have the luxury of time that feature films, live-action films, don't have.
Yeah, the movie business is very complicated, and oftentimes things get rushed because of other things, the star's availability, or they don't have a big film for the Christmas, you know, 2010 slot or something like that. And that seems to dictate what gets made. That said, you know, animation is complicated in many ways that live action is not, too. We don't get anything for free. We have to build every single thing you see on screen and have meetings discussing each thing and the texture of each thing. And, you know, some of it will be easier and some of it will probably be harder. But it's all filmmaking and all storytelling, and I'm really excited about it.
If you're just joining us, I'm Matt Holzman, and this is The Business. Our usual host, Claude Bardesser-Ackner, is talking with Brad Bird, the writer and director of the Pixar animated hits The Incredibles and Ratatouille.
Well, let's talk about where animation is headed. You've also said that there's a contingent of the digital effects community, and I'm quoting you here, to whom the holy grail is to create photographically real humans. To me, that is the dumbest goal you could possibly have, end quote. And so I wonder, like, what do you make of a director like Robert Zemeckis trying to do Polar Express or Beowulf?
Well, first of all, I think Zemeckis is a brilliant filmmaker, and a lot of my favorite films were directed by him. So here's my problem with that particular technique right now. Now, I think it's a valuable tool. Mm-hmm. I think that it is, and there is a place for it. I mean, I think Peter Jackson has used motion capture very well. What I think is strange is that, for me, it's neither fish nor fowl. In other words, it doesn't have the nuance of real live action, and it doesn't have the caricature of animation. So I think that if you use it as a starting point and then mess with it, like Peter Jackson does, you can get amazing results. But I think that the closer you try to adhere to making it just kind of transferring an actor's performance to a slightly different body, I don't know. Jury's still out for me. I think that there are better ways to use that tool.
You know, speaking of sort of feelings about movies, you once said, I love the medium of film. But that the strange dichotomy of film is that the medium is so unbelievably magical and wonderful, and the business is so ugh. And I don't know if I'm translating ugh with the right amount of disgust, but, you know, I'm just curious to ask you, like, what is it about the business that's most ugh to you?
Well, I mean, it's incredibly hard to get people to feel comfortable with investing resources on anything, you know, that, I mean, I guess it's because when you're talking about an idea or something you want to see on screen, it's, you're in a very light sort of absorbed mode that's almost childlike. And the business part of it is all this bureaucratic nonsense. And basically you're trying to keep people from being frightened. You know, people, you know, that want to keep their parking space. So the last thing they want to do is something that sounds remotely risky. So you're constantly trying to package your stuff to sound familiar and safe so that they will, you know, give you the resources to go ahead. And I just kind of wish that it was judged on that level, because the pie chart mentality is so not what makes movies special, you know. The business school graduate wants to feel that there's a repeatable, dependable set of circumstances that will always yield a hit. And the truth of the matter is, this is a gamble. Everybody's just kind of shrugging their shoulders and going, seems cool to me. I mean, it's all made on a very instinctive sort of childlike level. And I think that you either join that party or you don't, you stay away from it. And I hate them trying to impose business school logic on something as dreamlike as film. You just can't do it. And again, I don't see anybody having more consistent success not trusting their instincts than people who do. And you either have instinct or you don't. And if you have it, this is a business for you. If you don't, you know, go make widgets.
Well, we got to leave it there. Brad Bird is the writer and director of Ratatouille, nominated for 5 Oscars, including Best Animated Feature and Best Screenplay. He also wrote and directed the Oscar-winning film The Incredibles. Brad, thanks for being on The Business.
It's been fun. Thanks.
Here's Brad Bird as the voice of designer to the superheroes Edna Mode in The Incredibles, a role I believe should have earned him a Best Supporting Actor nomination. Actress nomination? Actor nomination?
I cut it a little roomy for the free movement. The fabric is comfortable for sensitive skin. And can also withstand the temperature of over 1,000 degrees. Completely bulletproof. And machine washable, darling. That's a new feature.
What on earth do you think the baby will be doing?
Well, I'm sure I don't know, darling. Luck favors the prepared. I didn't know the baby's powers, so I covered the basics.
Jack-Jack doesn't have any powers.
No? Well, good look fabulous anyway.
After a short break, do movies make money? You're listening to The Business from NPR. You're listening to The Business, and I'm Matt Holzman, sitting in for Claude Brodesser-Ackner. Late last year, the research firm Global Media Intelligence put out a provocative analysis of the studio's bottom line, with the even more provocative title, Do Movies Make Money? The answer is that while tons of money is being generated by the movie business, it isn't necessarily going to the studios. Contrary to what you might think based on those bloated box office numbers you see in the papers, the studios actually lose bushels of cash on the first cycle of a movie's life. That is, in theaters, then DVD, video on demand, cable TV, and so on. According to Global Media's analysis, studios are giving away a bigger and bigger share of what's called first dollar gross to star actors, directors, and producers. They're using outside money to protect themselves against the downside, but that then limits their upside. And let's not forget the runaway cost of making and marketing movies. Roger R. Smith is author of Do Movies Make Money and the co-founder of Global Media Intelligence, a media research service for major investors in media companies. Smith is no stranger to the business. He was an entertainment industry executive for 2 decades. Our host, Claude Brodesser-Ackner, talked with Smith when his report came out in October of last year. It's more relevant than ever as the writers continue to try to extract what money they can from the studios during their protracted contract negotiations.
Roger Smith, welcome to the business.
Thank you very much.
So your conclusion is that the movie-making business is a money-losing proposition. In fact, you say that from 2004 to 2006, the studios are going to lose $2 billion. During the current strike, you've been kind of vilified for giving the studios fodder for their, hey, we're broke, argument. Is somebody misunderstanding your conclusions?
Absolutely. And I was, frankly, as soon as this began, the process, and I said, oh, my God, that wasn't what I intended and certainly what isn't the import of what I'm saying. News Corp, Time Warner, Viacom, NBC Universal, they invested billions of dollars in the film business and are going to have losses to show for it over the coming years from their new production. The most important thing is that because they report overall profits, so people say, well, how can it be they're losing money? The profits come from the extraordinarily high profitability of the library titles. How many businesses get to make a product in 1939 called Gone with the Wind, that is, when it comes out in its special 50th anniversary and 60th anniversary DVD packages, is generating huge amounts of money for no additional investment beyond packaging and marketing.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a reason why people go into the film business and accept a much lower current return than most, if I may call them, normal businesses. The film business, I like to think of it as a kind of manic depressive business, and 2 years out of three, the studios tell the world what a great business they have, and 1 year out of three, they cry poverty, and that just happens to be when all the guild contracts are due.
Cunning. So the writers want to make more money from new media, and the studios say, we're broke. What's the real story here?
Well, the fact of the matter is that the writers, I think, have once again been suckered by the studios, because they are being made to believe that it is the future which they must make demands on a contract that is going to last 3 years and get renegotiated again, the digital downloads, etc. It is the present. It is the huge pile of money from DVD where they have labored for years with an extremely unfavorable formula that the studios cleverly put in back in the 80s and have told them that it's sacrosanct. We won't touch that formula. Well, that's where the money is.
Now, the big headline about your report came from the fact that you estimate profit participation, that is, you know, big stars who get first dollar gross and that sort of thing, has increased dramatically in the last few years, and that is cutting deeply into the studio's short and long-term profits. So we should ask you, first of all, why are stars getting these gigantic deals, and do you think that's money well spent? Because the consensus seems to be, you know, stars don't guarantee upside. They only protect against downside, and they're giving away the upside.
But, in fact, the protection against the downside is what the studio executives want. They simply do not want to be tagged with having given the green light to a massive loser. And with so much money involved, the stars are an insurance policy that the picture will open. If the picture is truly bad, it won't perform, but at least chances are you'll get most, if not all, of your money back.
Mm-hmm. Now, big producers like, you know, Brian Grazer and Ron Howard and Scott Rudin and Jerry Bruckheimer, these sort of household name guys, they often get what they call first dollar deals also. That's that they get paid before anybody gets paid, the studio or the movie theaters. Why is that? Especially since it seems like they take very little risk.
I would say the correct answer to that is I haven't a clue. The payments to them are not simply excessive, they are absurd. They are paid very handsome housekeeping deals, and on top of this, they put up zero money, except maybe they option a property for a couple of $1 million, which is the studio's money, too.
Mm-hmm. Now, you say in your report that studios like Fox and New Line are doing a bit better, or a lot better, actually, than the rest of the studios. Why is that?
They are the, I call it the sort of, the exception that proves the rule. It is not inherent in the movie business that you have to spend so much that you don't get it back. A Jim Carrey picture that they halted just weeks before it was to go into production because the budget rose over $112 million and they decided it wasn't worth it.
And they'd already spent millions on sets, on scripts, and everything.
They had done that, but it was a moment of great wisdom when they decided to call halt to it as opposed to say, well, we're in for $5 million and I don't want to take a write-off.
I think that's called throwing good money after bad.
Yes, which is something the industry consistently does. And look, everyone listening to this, I hope, understands that deciding which pictures the public is going to like is not a simple business. Doing it on a consistent basis is extremely hard. But if you would add financial discipline to good judgment about material, you get Fox and New Line. New Line pursues the business in a way like the old-fashioned independents, in that they keep domestic and they sell off the foreign and grossly reduce their risk. They're profitable every year, and last year was a year in which they didn't have a single hit, and they're going to make money.
Gotcha. So in your report, you say Hollywood must begin a serious attempt to rein in costs. And you add, I think, interestingly, and I'm quoting from you here, something well within the studio's power, end quote. So if that's true, why haven't they done it?
The biggest problem is this, and I think it's best illustrated by a little bit of history. In 1987 or 8, I believe, Bob Daley was running Warner Brothers, and John Hughes had come in with a project called Home Alone. It was originally budgeted at a now somewhat quaint-sounding $14 million. When John Hughes informed Mr. Daley, and I have this all on hearsay, but good hearsay, that it was going to cost $17 million. Bob drew a line in the sand and said, no, we'll bring it back from Chicago. We'll shoot it on the lot. We're not going to spend $3 million more. It's 14 or nothing. Mr. Hughes picked up the phone to Joe Roth, who was then head of production at Fox, and I'm told he got a yes in 20 minutes over the phone. Fox has probably pulled in $800 million of profit from Home Alone 1, 2, and 3, related merchandise, DVDs, etc. So everybody is so afraid that they're going to be the one who is laughed at because they were, you know, worried about a couple million dollars.
So if they know what they have to do, why haven't they done it?
Ego is the simplest reason. I think it is a business driven by the gross, and the net is always going to be secondary. It's just in the nature of it. It's in the fact that everybody in America picks up their newspaper or clicks on the internet Sunday night or Monday morning and knows what every picture grossed that weekend.
Roger, we got to leave it there. Roger R. Smith is the co-founder and executive editor of Global Media Intelligence, a media research service for major investors in media companies. He was an entertainment industry executive from 74 to 96. He joined us from studios in New York. Roger, thanks for being on The Business.
Thank you so much.
And that's The Business. I'm Matt Holzman, and I produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Greg Guarna. Our associate producer is Darby Maloney. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can also podcast this show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and is